Welcome to For the Health of It, starring Dr. Jenny Brook, vitality expert and wellness chiropractor at Spinal Corrective Center in Amherst, New Hampshire. She is joined by producer Mike Clark. This dynamic, sometimes crazy, sometimes funny, and always entertaining duo will inspire you to eat, move, sleep, think, and live better. You're listening to Raw Talk about full potential living for the health of it.
Ah, oh, feels so good to be back into the studio.
Well, it's warm anyway.
It is. It's warm and cozy. There's a snowstorm going on outside.
There's always a snowstorm going on outside lately.
Seriously.
Oh my God.
For those of you listening overseas, we live in New England, which is basically winter 6 months of the year.
I had some nice snowflakes on my way in, though. Tasty.
Do you like the snowstorms?
No.
I'm
sick of driving to work in the snow.
Yeah. It's kind of fun, but...
And that would be Emily you're listening to, our awesome co-host, and Michael Clark, producer.
Michael, wow.
I know.
We're being formal
She's
today.
She's so formal.
And you're so you bald today. Name. Your hair is all gone.
You must have just
shaved it, though.
I did,
Maybe
yes.
He just had a stressful weekend.
Oh, Michael. Mike. Okay,
oh.
So I have a question for you, Mike, because you love it when I start with questions
you
for you.
You always do.
I do.
Throw me under the bus right away.
We're going to do some in the news segments here. And
my favorite.
I know, aren't they fun? And here's something that was actually on NPR recently, just within the last couple days. It was an article, Why Teens Are Impulsive, Addiction Prone, and Should Protect Their Brains. Were you an impulsive kid as a teenager?
Yeah, I was a wild teenager.
Really?
I was pretty wild.
I mean, when I think back to, like, I reflect on my siblings. You know, I had two older brothers. Man, they were definitely impulsive. Like, talk about, like, not thinking about the consequences before you make a choice.
Well, you think you're invincible when you're that age. You know, it's like, nothing's going to happen to me, so I'll dive off this cliff into the quarry, you know?
I'm trying to think of the craziest thing I ever did when I was a teenager. Can you think of what you might have done?
No, I'd have to edit it.
I don't think I want my parents to know, and they might listen to
right,
this.
Exactly.
The article talks about how teens can't control impulses. They can't make these like really fast, smart decisions like an adult can. And they wanted to know why. So there's actual research into how the brain develops as a human. And as a teenager, it talks about how the frontal lobe of the brain, and that's the part of the brain that controls decision making, it's built by teen age, but it's not fully insulated. So the signals move more slowly. So basically, this author, the name is Dr. Francis Jensen, wrote a book called The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. I think I need to read this book. And the author says teenagers are not as readily able to access their frontal lobe to say, oh, I better not do this.
Is that why they're reckless?
I think about how scary it is to have these things out on the road, you know? I mean, they're
exactly.
backing
think
up
about
and going
that.
Out the wrong way. My friend drove down a one-way street when we were teenagers.
Wow.
Like
That's actually how I got into a rear-end serious collision.
Do you think 16's too young to drive a car?
Personally.
I do too, actually.
New England winters.
You really have to have your wits about you to be in a car.
It's very dangerous.
Well, interestingly, how a teenager is prone to impulsiveness, moodiness, and not being very good at responsible decision making is all related to the frontal lobe of the brain. So we have natural insulation. It's called myelin. And it's a fat, and it takes time to grow. And the cells have to build myelin, and they grow it around the outside of these tracts, and it takes years. Brains aren't fully mature until people are in their early 20s, sometimes late 20s, and maybe even beyond that.
I'm still waiting on mine.
You need a little more myelin?
I do, yeah.
So next time you're irresponsible, you'll be like, Mike, we need more myelin.
I'm going to be so happy when he grows up.
I agree with that, just because the number of rash and unthought through decisions that I've made.
Well, and so your prefrontal cortex and your frontal cortex are, these are the areas where we have insight, empathy, and then executive functions. If you've heard of executive functions, it's impulse control, risk-taking behavior. And they're saying this might explain why teenagers can be especially susceptible to even addictions like drugs, alcohol, smoking, and digital devices.
So now they have an excuse.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But Mom, it's just my brain. I can't do anything about it.
So we should all get our teenagers a bodyguard is what you're saying.
Or give them less responsibility or expect less from them. I mean, really, you see this all the time. A 15, 14-year-old boy can look like a complete adult.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this kind of sense that, well, they should be, you know, completely responsible. Not to say that they shouldn't be, but interesting how sometimes their behavior is actually because their brains aren't fully developed.
Yeah, I think we need to let kids be kids. You know, sometimes we push them along and we expect them to be adults, and they're not. You know,
well, and especially in today's competitive school markets, you know, high school and college, there's a lot expected of children.
No doubt. Yeah.
Well, and moving on, you know, there's this whole thing about you become a teenager and it's time to start wearing deodorant and antiperspirant. Right?
Oh, yeah.
This sounds like a salty topic.
So there's this article. This one's on Mercola.com, and it was just recent. And it was called Antiperspirants Can Make You Smell Worse by Altering Armpit Bacteria.
I read this article, too, and I thought Mercola was personally attacking me about my body odor.
You don't have body odor.
It's true.
Well, I have to say that I've met Dr. Joseph Mercola, and I've stood next, like right next to him, and had a picture taken and had a long conversation with him.
Did you get a good whiff?
He had on a V-neck, a cashmere sweater, and it was in hot California weather, and I in no way detected any body odor from him.
Fresh as a rose, the man was.
So I believe that he might have something to say here. So I think we should take it seriously.
Now, is he talking about teenage kids, though?
That was my segue. He's talking about, it was reported by a publication called Real Clear Science about how antiperspirants, that's what makes you not sweat. That's the part of the
right of the
stick, you know, because there's
dry.
The deodorant, which makes you not smell, and antiperspirants, which make you not sweat. So sometimes you might just have a deodorant. Sometimes it's a deodorant antiperspirant. The antiperspirants affect the bacterial balance in your armpits, which can make you smell even worse, develop a problem.
Really?
Yeah. So the reason your sweat smells is because there's a certain kinds of bacteria that live in your armpits that break down lipids and amino acids that are found in your sweat into substances that have, you know, distinct odors. So Dr. Mercola talks about how antiperspirants address this problem by using antimicrobial agents to kill the bacteria, and then other ingredients such as aluminum that block your sweat glands.
That's what makes your white t-shirts yellow, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, there's actually chemicals that make the t-shirt yellow. So there was an actual study that in the study, some of the study participants pledged not to use deodorant or antiperspirant for an entire month.
Ugh.
And yeah, and
I hope
some,
it was in the winter.
And some stopped using their deodorants only, and some stopped using their antiperspirant deodorant, and others did not really use either, and they were asked to start using deodorant for a month.
I have a confession to make. I probably haven't worn deodorant in like 5 years.
Okay, well, then this is going to be interesting because in the study, the duration was 28 days because that's about how long it takes for new layers of skin cells to form.
Really?
Yes. So every subject in the study ended up altering their bacterial composition of their armpits. Before and after was different. And it's a challenge to determine exact changes because every person's microbiome is distinct. It's individual. We're all different. But the researchers did find one clear trend. Those who use antiperspirants had a definite increase in a bacteria called actinobacteria. Now, that bacteria is what's responsible for that foul-smelling armpit odor.
Imagine being the researcher for that.
I know. Yeah.
Oh,
how was work today? Stink. It stunk.
So by making themselves not sweat, they increased the bacteria that caused their armpits to smell. And what's interesting is he points out that the situation here is much like it is in our guts. You know, when we eat foods or we take drugs that kill off the healthy bacteria,
right,
more of the harmful ones are allowed to take over.
Yeah, so, I was just going to say, this is like antibiotics.
It is. So here, you know, the less odor-causing bacteria are killed off by the aluminum. That allows the bacteria that have these pungent odors to thrive instead.
Huh, interesting. That's fascinating.
And even more interesting is the participants that went off the antiperspirants, their population of actinobacteria dwindled to virtually non-existent. So the take-home message is using an antiperspirant can make you stink from your armpits more pronounced, while quitting antiperspirants actually help mellow the smell.
I'm going to go home and test my actinobacteria.
So far I've learned a lot about my brain and my armpits.
You have.
Yeah.
And I think we should talk a little more about this whole aluminum thing, because there's other problems with aluminum. And one of which is they've been shown in research that they can be carcinogenic, meaning they can contribute to an increased cancer risk.
I think we've talked about that on a show before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And basically because they block your pores that release sweat, and sweat is one way you get toxins out.
Right.
But the thing with aluminum salts is they can also mimic estrogen. And it's absorbed and it can be put into breast tissue. So it actually increases your risk of breast cancer. It's also, aluminum is also widely recognized as a neurotoxin, and Alzheimer's patients typically have elevated levels of aluminum in their brains. So let's talk to Emily. So seriously, I want to hear this, because I know other people in my life who said, okay, I'm just going to stop using it. Did it take long for your body to regulate again?
I don't think I really ever stunk. That's why I stopped using it. But I don't ever smell, and no one...
You're as fresh as a daisy.
It's true. I mean, I also don't sweat, but...
Well, and Dr. Mercola recommends, you know, when it comes to antiperspirants, especially avoid them. And, you know, what he does, he actually goes into his own personal routine, and maybe this is similar to yours. He finds that if he just regularly washes his armpits with soap and makes sure his diet's clean with minimal sugar, plenty of fermented vegetables, then everything kind of stays in balance and
really?
This odor's not offensive.
So this is actually really interesting. People that eat a lot of sugar, meat, and dairy tend to smell worse than, like, say, vegetarians.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I've read that. The cleaner your diet, the better it is.
Exactly. Especially, for everything. You can, like, pick them out of a crowd, you know?
Well, and he showed two other things that can help. You could still try a pinch of baking soda mixed with water. That's an effective all-day deodorant. That's pretty simple. And he also noticed that sunbathing your armpits regularly helped basically the UV light sterilize the area.
Just another reason to go tanning.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Just kidding.
So I want to read a quote from him because it's really interesting. Dr. Mercola says, soap tends to remove the protective sebum that is full of beneficial fats that your body uses to protect your skin. So sad and wasteful that so many regularly use soap to wash their entire skin surface and remove this protective covering and then pay money to apply lotions to restore what they just removed. The irony is that most of the lotions are far inferior to sebum, and many, if not most, are loaded with toxic ingredients that ultimately will worsen your health. So he only uses soap on his armpits and his private parts. The rest he just washes off with water.
It's so fascinating. I could talk about this all day. You know, I also stopped a while back using face wash on my face, and I just put like olive oil on it when I get out of the shower, and it's like the best thing that ever happened to my skin.
Yeah, I've done the same thing. I've stopped using like dramatic soaps to wash my face at all. I just rinse it really well and pat it.
Because otherwise you just dry it out, and then, like you said, you put more lotion on it.
Yeah.
It's the same idea with a lot of shampoos. They say you strip the oils, and then you use conditioner to put it back.
Exactly. I know nothing of shampoo.
Yeah, so washing your hair less.
Oh, you don't shampoo using
non-sudsing shampoos actually helps keep the natural oils in your hair. Yeah, very, very interesting, everybody.
Fascinating.
Okay, you ready for a geek moment?
I'm always ready for a geek
moment. Oh, this is so good. Okay, so this is a website called phys.org. So phys like physics, phys.org.
I get it.
And, I thought it was phys like a soda.
And it just was a few months ago, and total geek moment. So according to the traditional theory of nerves, two nerve impulses sent from opposite ends of a nerve annihilate when they collide. That's what people used to think. So
they cancel each other out.
Yeah. So new research from the Niels Bohr Institute, that's in Copenhagen, it now shows that two colliding nerve impulses simply pass through each other and continue unaffected.
Wow.
Okay, this is where it gets cool, because
they're like ghosts.
There was a theory studied in 2005 and it was published in 2006, and this supports it, that nerve functions are less electrical signals and it's more of a sound impulse. Our nerves are more sound waves.
Like a waveform, yeah.
Yes. And this was published in the scientific journal Physical Review X. So here's the cool thing, and this is how it relates to chiropractic, is nerve signals control the communication between the billions of cells in an organism and enable them to work together in neural networks. That's what the article says. And we know that through chiropractic, the whole point is keeping your spine healthy allows the communication system of the nerve system to be unimpeded.
So you tell me, yes.
So this is so cool, because, you know, back in it was 1952, Hodgkin and Huxley, that's the people who introduced this model where they believe nerve signals were described as an electrical current. and like the flow of ions. And for more than 60 years, all medical and biology textbooks said that the nerve's function is due to an electric current along the nerve pathway. This is what I was taught in school. This is what I have taught my patients for years. And, right. and just in the last few months, we've been shown that's not even true. And this is what I think is cool about that. We don't even understand how the nerves work. You know, as chiropractors, our job is just to help keep pressure on off of them so they can do the job that they need to do.
Yes.
What do you think the implications of it are that now that we know it's more of a wave rather than an electric force?
Well, and to understand what these implications might be, I'm not even sure, other than the fact of we've just proven that the body's way more complex and amazing, that we can't just recreate this. That's why, you know, taking serious nerve disorders, say Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis, it's so hard to just regenerate nerve. You know, you think of people who've had nerve disorders, you can't just regenerate nerve.
Yeah, because they don't quite understand it yet.
Yeah. This author, Thomas Heimberg, he said, the nerve impulse can therefore be explained by the fact that the pulse is a mechanical wave in the form of a sound pulse that moves along the nerve membrane. And by the way, the study that he did it in earthworms and lobsters. So wait, are you ready for a geekier moment?
I don't think we can get any geekier than that.
I love this sentence so much. There's two sentences that I just have to read them as is because it's the coolest thing ever. When the sound pulse moves through the nerve pathway, the membrane changes locally from a liquid to a more solid form. The membrane is compressed slightly, and this change leads to an electric impulse as a consequence of the piezoelectric effect.
Who invited Bill Nye?
You know what that is? You know what you're describing, believe it or not? What we're talking into. A microphone.
Yeah.
Because we're taking a sound wave and we're turning it into electrical energy through the diaphragm and the microphone.
Oh, that's so cool.
Oh, wow.
And I also think it might explain that there's so much more to an adjustment versus, you know, mechanical pressure off of nerve.
Right.
You know, you're stimulating the ability for the sound wave to get through.
Oh, we're nerding out.
So cool. Okay, but after that, man, it is time for a break. But when we come back, we are going to study a little bit about ADHD. And believe I even checked this baby on Snopes. And we're going to talk a little bit about six reasons why you should sleep in the nude.
You're listening to Raw Talk about Full Potential Living for the health of it. Your host is Dr. Jenny Brook, vitality expert and wellness chiropractor at Spinal Corrective Center in Amherst, New Hampshire. If you're in the southern New Hampshire area, you can schedule a health consultation and examination with Dr. Jenny. To schedule, call 673-5600. That's 673-5600. For more information about Spinal Corrective Center, go to www.spinalcorrectivecenter.com or call 673-5600. To find a chiropractor in your area, go to www.chiropractic.org/doctorfinder. Now back to Raw Talk about Full Potential Living for the health of it.
So we're back from break and we are talking about articles in the news. And here's the thing. We report the article. We give you our opinions. We let you say, that's interesting, and make your own.
So far, it's been pretty heady stuff.
We add a few sarcastic comments in to make you laugh.
Maybe.
It'll get easier, Mike. It'll get easier.
Oh, good.
So we know that you were impulsive as a teenager. Did you have attention issues? Do you think you would have been diagnosed with ADHD if that was the rage back then?
I don't think so.
Why are you chasing that butterfly over there, Mike?
Was I supposed to be doing this? Yeah. No, I'm actually pretty focused.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. You'd have to be the work that you did.
Yeah.
I think I would have been considered a focused child either. Yeah, what about you, Em?
See, she can't decide.
I don't know if I have any teachers listening. I don't want to offend anyone.
Well, there was an article on your newswire.com, and it was posted by a woman named Louise Turner. And interestingly, is I guess this has been going around the internet, and it's basically an article called "Is ADHD a Fictitious Disease?" So ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and supposedly this U.S. American psychiatrist Leon Eisenberg, who was born back in 1922, he was the son of Russian Jewish immigrants. He was like the scientific father of ADHD, but on his supposable deathbed at the age of 87, his very last interview, he said ADHD is a prime example of a fictitious disease.
Really, and they toss that around a lot now with kids.
Fascinating. You
know? Well, and so the article goes on to say that, you know, ADHD drugs are increasingly prescribed. And what gets crazy is they gave some numbers here, and you know, they're as young as preschoolers are getting these drugs, and you know, it's just never been studied at that age.
Which is kind of scary, because tying into the first part of the podcast, their brains are not developed and they're getting prescribed drugs for brains that aren't developed yet.
Yeah, they're getting prescribed in amphetamines.
And not to mention, they're being overloaded with information that they can't even process yet and overstimulated from things in their environment. This is so sad.
It's despite the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics, they don't have any guidelines for prescribing amphetamines for children below the age of 4. But yet this like major study revealed that ADHD drugs, they've never been proven safe and effective, but yet they're prescribed more and more and more. Something like 5.4 million kids, you know, and at least 10,000 of them are under the age of 4. So this study, it was led by researchers from Boston's Children's Hospital at the Department of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and other institutions. They concluded that the clinical trials for drugs approved as treatment for ADHD were not designed to assess adverse events or long-term safety and efficacy, which I see that in my practice. Kids who come in with tic-type disorders, verbal or physical tics, from Ritalin or from Adderall.
Right.
And according to the information that was given in the study, 2/3 of the 6.4 million American children, that's what it was, 6.4 million, including 10,000 toddlers, diagnosed with this alleged ADHD are nothing short of a fraudulent, life-threatening drug experiment.
Wow,
that's a pretty
scary.
That's a pretty big statement to make.
It's a product of 12 million exhausted parents.
Well, and this Harvard psychologist, Jerome Kagan, said, you know, every child who's not doing well in school is sent to see a pediatrician, and the pediatrician says, oh, it's ADHD, here's Ritalin.
Right.
And in fact, you know, 90% of these 5.4 million, according to this Harvard psychologist, he said, don't have an abnormal dopamine metabolism. The problem is, if the drug is available to doctors, they'll just make the corresponding diagnosis.
Sad.
So then we have this guy who is in charge of this whole thing basically say, you know, at the end of my life, really, the whole thing was fictitious. So I went to Snopes.com to see, well, what do they say about this? So they actually said it's partly true. This really did happen when they researched it. They basically said, this is what they said wasn't always true. They said, however, allowing for the vagaries, is that the word? Of translation and reading the statement in context, some native German speakers, because it was reported in German language, have reported that Dr. Eisenberg wasn't asserting that ADHD is a real disorder, but rather that it is overdiagnosed.
Well, that, no doubt about that.
So there you go.
Well, that's important information. That was an important little segment right there.
Well, and you know, 10-year-old boys take an ADHD drug every day.
Yeah, we're guys. We're easily distracted, usually by girls.
Yes. So you want to hear what the French do?
Oui, oui.
We always want to hear what the French do. So here's another article. It was by Marilyn Wedge, PhD, because she wrote a book called A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. So she says in the U.S., at least 9% of school-aged children have been diagnosed with ADHD, and they're taking a pharmaceutical medication. So 9% of kids. That's where they get the 1 in 10 boys.
Right.
In France, the percentage of kids diagnosed and medicated is less than 0.5%. So her question was, well, how is this epidemic that's firmly established in the U.S. almost completely passed over children in France? So the question is it a biological neurological disorder? So in the U.S., what happens is child psychiatrists consider ADHD to be a biological disorder with biological causes. You're missing a chemical in your brain. You have to take this chemical to fix it.
Right.
The preferred treatment's always biological, you know, a psychostimulant medication such as Ritalin or Adderall. But French child psychiatrists, on the other hand, view ADHD as a medical condition that has psychosocial and situational causes. So instead of treating a children's focus and behavioral problems with a drug, they tend to look for the underlying issue that's causing the child distressed, not in the brain.
Yeah, it's called adolescence.
Right, but in the child's social, and their social context. The parents just got divorced. They just change homes.
Yeah, stuff happens.
And
they
take the time to treat the underlying social context problem with like psychotherapy or family counseling. And it's a very different way of seeing things from the American tendency to say all symptoms are due to a biological dysfunction, like a chemical imbalance in the brain.
Yeah.
So The other thing that I thought was interesting is the French, because they have a more holistic, more of like a psychosocial approach, they also consider nutritional causes for ADHD type symptoms.
Sure.
Right? Specifically, the fact that the behavior of some children is worsened after eating foods with artificial colors, certain preservatives, and allergens, foods they're
food
sensitive
allergies.
To.
Yeah.
When I have a parent say, I think my child is hyperactive, I'll say, get all food coloring out first. Do that first.
I teach high school every day. You can't even believe what these kids eat in high school. I'm just shocked at the food that they're eating. It's just junk.
My little
it's
brother
awful.
Started going to a public high school, and I would ask him, what'd you have for lunch today? Every day, burgers, french fries, pizza.
Oh, it's worth it. The kids today were eating ramen noodles with like processed chocolate pudding,
which they don't even
Cheetos.
Allow high fructose corn syrup in Europe. Like, we have stuff in our diet.
Exactly.
So, definitely look to, it's got to, nutrition, allergies and things like that. It could be any of that stuff.
I couldn't even find peanut butter when I was living in France.
Really?
True.
I'd go nuts.
So as an American parent, if you have a child diagnosed with ADHD or symptoms of that, just dig deeper.
Yeah.
Be an advocate for your child to say, what can we address either nutritionally or socially in the home or in the school setting, or maybe they're not just in the right environment for them. We kind of had these American schools that have children have to fit into this role, sit at a desk and read from their textbook. And some kids, it's just not going to be the fit for them.
Nope.
And remember, their little brains aren't even fully built. So do you really want to build it with a,
a chemical.
A chemical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, this is about adults, but this article, and it's from Fox News, it gives 6 reasons why you should sleep in the nude. It's saying to pack away your flannel pajamas. And there's a handful of studies and surveys that show sleeping naked could actually be good for you. So let's see what we think. The first one is you may like your partner more.
True.
Isn't this interesting? So
that's not they might like you more, right?
No, you may like your partner more. This was a 2014 survey of Brits by Cotton USA, which is interesting because it promotes...
They make pajamas.
They make pajamas and
right,
sheets.
Yeah.
But they found that 57% of those who slept nude reported being happy in their relationship. This is 9% higher than PJ wearers. But here's the weird thing. It's 43% higher than nightie wearers.
Awkward. Wow. Who still wears 90s? Don't raise your hand.
And oddly enough, it was also 38% higher than onesie wearers. Apparently, that still exists. Like a
onesie.
You got us those when you're at Christmas.
Hopefully, they have the trap
door. Because we live in New England winter.
It was hard to answer the door, for the milkman in those.
You zip it all the way up, and there's just 2 little holes for the feet that you can walk around in. They're fantastic. Okay, number 2. Sleeping in the nude could help prevent diabetes.
How's that happen?
Well,
yeah, do tell.
The article admits it's a bit of a stretch, but here's the logic. This is what it says. Adults have small amounts of brown fat, which is also known as the good fat, in their bodies. And a 2014 study looked at how bedroom temperature affected the fat. So it was a 4-month study and it was small. They only had 5 men who slept in rooms heated to 66 degrees, 75, and 81. And after 4 weeks spent at the coldest temperature, the men had almost twice as much brown fat and their insulin sensitivity was better. And the researcher said that could lower their diabetes risk. So sleeping in colder temperatures, which they're
freezing.
Saying...
We shut our heat off at night, so it's freezing.
Well, and the idea is if you sleep without clothing, you're putting yourself
you're
in
cooler.
A colder temperature.
Well, how about you guys? I'm dying to know.
I like a sauna to go to sleep in, personally.
I like lots of warm blankets.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
So
too.
I don't need to wear clothing. Yeah. The third one is it's better for your lady health. Yeah, Dr. Jennifer Landa, who points out, an overly warm environment could spur too much yeast or bacteria to grow in the vaginal area.
Right.
So she's saying given air, access to the region prevents infections. And that is a really good thing to do with yeast infections, just sleep without underwear for a while. So number 4, it's how our ancestors did it. So this is what it says. If you're a paleo dieter who eats like a caveman, why not sleep like one too?
That's right. I put a rock under my head every night.
Neurologist Rachel Salas from the Johns Hopkins Center for Sleep said in 2013 in the Wall Street Journal that back in the cave days, people slept naked. We also know, this is number 5, it could be better for your immune system to sleep naked. Yeah, isn't this cool?
I don't need any more reasons, really. The first one I thought of.
This is my favorite reason. So when skin-on-skin contact occurs, our adrenal glands get a message to lighten up on the production of the stress hormone cortisol.
So I'm back to my first reason then.
There you go. Cortisol suppresses the immune system. So skin-to-skin contact also increases levels of oxytocin, which can have positive effects on blood pressure and healing.
It's like getting a giant hug.
Lastly, body temperature affects your sleep. In a 2004 study found that for sleep to initiate normally, core body temperature matters. So studies of sleep onset insomniacs show that they consistently have a warmer core body temperature immediately before initiating sleep when compared with normal healthy adults. So to go to bed a little bit cold actually gives you better sleep. So going to bed naked, where you get under the covers and it feels cold, you eventually warm up, but you actually will initiate sleep better if you go to bed feeling a little bit cold.
Fantastic.
Isn't that interesting?
More reasons to get naked.
Well, it's always good to know another reason to sleep naked.
I like that.
Oh, on that note, be well, everybody.
You've been listening to Raw Talk about Full Potential Living for the health of it. Your host was Dr. Jenny Brook, vitality expert and wellness chiropractor at Spinal Corrective Center in Amherst, New Hampshire. If you live in the southern New Hampshire area, schedule a health checkup with Dr. Jenny at 673-5600. That's 673-5600. For more information about Spinal Corrective Center, call 673-5600 or check out www.spinalcorrectivecenter.com. You can also find Dr. Jenny on Facebook at Spinal Corrective Center. Thank you for listening to Raw Talk about Full Potential Living for the health of it.